G7 leaders wrap up and head home, leaving open questions about the U.S. and Iran sitting down to talk, and about global markets in the middle of the U.S. trade war with China.
A small positive move in the market might reflect things aren't really, really terrible, rather than things aren't really, really, really terrible.
I'm Marco Werman. Climate activists were also at the G7 with a clear message to politicians.
We need now no more blah blah, no more speech, but we need actions.
Meanwhile, the Amazon continues to burn and indigenous people there are alarmed. Also today, space crime. Really? Space crime?
Imagine maybe someone rips a hole in someone else's spacesuit on the surface of Mars and it results in a homicide. How will the court system operate?
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. Lebanon's president is pointing the finger at Israel and talking about a declaration of war. Meanwhile, Israeli troops on the northern border with Lebanon are on high alert today because the Iranian-backed Lebanese militia Hezbollah is threatening imminent military action. All this comes after reports of Israeli drone strikes over the weekend inside Lebanon. Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes next door inside Syria since the civil war began there as well back in 2011. But recent news reports point to Israeli involvement in attacks in Lebanon and in Iraq as well. Ehud Aaron is a professor of international relations at the University of Haifa in Israel. Ehud Aaron, what's going on here from Israel's perspective? And do you see it as all part of the confrontation between Israel and Iran?
Yes, Marco, you're absolutely correct. The fundamental fact is Israel's efforts to try and curb Iranian military buildup in the region. Israel views Iran as a threat. There are two other specific contexts to the escalation we're witnessing now. One is a political context. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going to elections September 17th. And one of his biggest selling tickets is his image as Mr. Security, the defender of Israel. There's also a military context. The Israel Defense Forces takes a disproportionate role in military decision-making. So this is a multi-level game, if you will.
So let me ask you about the political context for a moment Benjamin Netanyahu shoring up his Mr. Security bona fides. I mean, there is that national election just a few weeks away. Are you worried about a wag the dog effect here, you know, that the attacks right now are politically motivated?
I don't believe they're fully politically motivated. There is general consensus in Israel, including among the opposition, that Iran is a threat. And moreover, Prime Minister Netanyahu, contrary to his image, has been very careful in the use of military force. What he is doing is taking a consensual military effort and trying to leverage it as much as he can politically.
But why these attacks now? I mean, isn't Iran the same essential threat to Israel it was like last year?
There are two developments that indeed warrant closer look. One is the expansion of attacks to Iraq. Israel does not take full responsibility of these, by the way. So that's also another effort maybe not to create chaos in the region. The second attack, which you referred to, was in Lebanon. Here, the details are not fully clear. It is something that was unprecedented. You're right, it's not exactly clear why now we're expanding to Iraq. One possibility is that Israel's effort to contain Iran in Syria had been generally successful, and so the Iranians are developing infrastructure in Iraq, and Israel wants to expand there.
But even with Israel not claiming responsibility, I mean, the reports of Israeli airstrikes in Syria and Lebanon and Iraq, I mean, it all seems pretty provocative. Isn't Israel the aggressor here?
So this goes to how do you define aggression? It's true in first glance that Israel took the action and attacked targets in the region. Seen from Israel, however, the slow buildup of Iranian military capabilities and support for its proxies in the region is the aggression. And therefore, Israel is merely responding to an Iranian encroachment.
So a tantalizing little glimmer at the G7 today, Emmanuel Macron announcing that there could be a potential meeting between Iran and the U.S. What are all these reports of attacks by Israel across the Mideast? I mean, how will that sidetrack it and how will that impact U.S.-Israeli relations?
So in first glance, it's a destabilizing component. This is an escalation between the armed conflict between Israel and Iran's proxies in the region, in which Iranians get hurt from time to time. Iran may calculate that the deal with the U.S. is more important, and therefore it will constrain any response by Hezbollah or any of its other allies. On the other hand, the U.S. May see Israeli behavior as adding to the pressure on Iran in the context of its negotiations with Iran. We know President Trump is driven by a transactional approach. Finally, I would say Israel and especially its defense establishment are very close to the U.S. and would be very careful to take any action that challenges or threatens American interests in the region.
Ehud Eron with the University of Haifa in Israel, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for including me. Take care.
China and the United States are in the midst of a serious trade war. That much we know, but exactly where we're at is hard to figure out, especially after contradictory statements from President Trump over the last few days. Today, we heard this.
China called last night our top trade people and said, let's get back to the table, so we'll be getting back to the table.
Even that's not been confirmed. But it comes after Trump called his Chinese counterpart America's top enemy, and he said he wants more tariffs. Even so, that whiff of somewhat encouraging news in the trade war was enough to help lift the markets today. Michael Klein teaches economics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and is editor of Econofact.org. Michael, what is your sense? Are the U.S. and China heading back to the negotiating table?
I think it's very hard to tell at this point because we've been whipsawed back and forth with contradictory information. And in the past, the president has said things about trade deals being completed when in fact they weren't. And we just don't know at this point.
Why do you think the markets appear to be responding positively?
You can't read too much into any small movement of the market. It looked much worse. So people thought things were going to go really badly. Maybe there's a little bit more hope. But again, a small positive move in the markets might reflect things aren't really, really terrible rather than things aren't really, really, really terrible.
How does China see this? I mean, how much is China hurting from this trade war? Is the pain making them reconsider negotiations, do you think?
There's evidence that the Chinese economy is slowing down, and the trade war probably has something to do with that. But the trade war doesn't help us really either. Inflicting pain on the world economy comes back to get us as well.
You know, a lot of people look at the White House and believe that nothing's going on. But, you know, some people do believe that the White House has a strategy to try to separate the U.S. economy from the Chinese economy in terms of reducing interdependence for goods and services. Are you seeing that? And do you think it's a good thing?
I think that there is an effort to separate the United States economy from China, but I don't think that's a good thing. International supply chains are so pervasive now that an effort to try to separate out a country that has been an important part of the international supply chain is going to be very disruptive for firms in the United States.
So finally, how is all this changing the Chinese perception of Washington? What does Beijing see right now? Not just the Trump administration, but what does Beijing see with the U.S. government more broadly?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that Beijing is not a unitary actor. There are different interest groups. There's the People's Bank of China. There's a trade group and so on. And what they're seeing probably most prominently is the inconsistency in the policy and trying to figure out how to act with that inconsistency. In some ways, people might think that this is a good thing. But on the other hand, the real problem with China has to do with things like intellectual property, things that would have been much better addressed through a multinational effort, through, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But that was scuttled in the very first days of this administration.
Are the Chinese getting any more fluent with the inconsistency in Washington?
I don't think anyone is getting any more fluent with the inconsistency in Washington. By definition, the inconsistency is very difficult to follow.
Michael Klein, professor of economics at Tufts and editor of the Econofact.org newsletter. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
What a long, hot summer this has been in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere. Here, France's heat waves also made headlines. Japan also suffered. Heat actually killed dozens of people there this summer and sent thousands more to the hospital. Lots of people in Japan rely on air conditioning when temps soar. But the settings on the AC and the way they use it, that might surprise you. Abigail Leonard reports from Tokyo.
Summer in Tokyo is hot, really hot, and oppressively humid. The other day when it was 96 and my weather app told me it felt like 108, I took my two kids to a water festival at the Higo Hosokawa Public Garden. When we get there, a woman leads me inside to help me put on a yukata. It's sort of a casual, lightweight kimono. hot, isn't it? She says. All right, so now that we have our yukatas fit, we're going to go do the water ceremony. So there's just a long row of people in beautiful flowered yukatas, and they have buckets in front of them and these big ladles, and they're taking the ladles and throwing the water on the ground. It's actually really beautiful, sort of like late afternoon light and these big arcing sprays of water. And the children are doing a great job of getting the water everywhere.
I sprayed
you. Oh, you did spray me. I'm a little bit wet. You sprayed, I think, everything here. The name for this is uchimizu, the ancient Japanese tradition of spreading water on roads and in front of homes to cool the air. It's been shown to lower the surface temperature by a couple degrees. Here's Koji Yamono, who organized the event. It's not like air conditioning, he says, but it does give a nice feeling of coolness during the summer heat. Of course, most Japanese households do have air conditioning, about 90%, the same as the U.S. But it's used slightly differently here. I spoke with Takase Abe from Daikin Industries, one of Japan's largest air conditioner manufacturers.
I can show you a picture.
He opens a catalog so I can see the most popular air conditioners in Japan and in the U.S.
Average Japanese family has this system.
It's three ceiling-mounted units, one in the parents' bedroom, one in the kids' room, and one in the living room. And they're all separately controlled. Then he shows me their most popular model in the U.S., Central Air, which cools the whole house. Japanese prefer separate units because electricity is more expensive here.
Japanese people like to save energy and save money, so they use a separate room system.
I have that kind of system in my Tokyo apartment. You only cool the space you're using. So I'm setting it to 75 degrees. That's high for the U.S. Most Americans keep their AC at 73 or lower, but that would be considered really cold in Japan. The government's official recommendation? Set your AC to 82 degrees. I asked Abe, the Daikin rep, about that.
American people, it's very sensitive to the heat, so they really love to set a lower temperature.
Yeah, yeah. Like 82 degrees Fahrenheit would seem very warm.
it's standard in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. For some Japanese people, American AC culture can be surprising. Goki Sagakuchi works for Tokyo Stock Exchange and spent 3 years in New York. He's a busy guy, so I had to catch him by phone during his lunch break at his desk. He told me he was freezing in his New York office.
So it's kind of embarrassing, but I had to wear blankets.
Blankets in the office.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I am totally familiar with that. Like the cold air-conditioned New York office. Yeah. He says that would never happen in Japan. Here, people think it's unhealthy to move between temperature extremes. There's a word for a summer cold or flu, natsukaze, which is thought to be caused by the stress of going from cold to hot air.
Yeah, temperature difference between indoor and outdoor really affects our bodies, I guess.
That idea has roots in Chinese medicine, and you see it play out in all kinds of ways. Like water is served lukewarm, even on the record-breaking hot days we've been having here this summer. Back at the water festival, the ground is soaked, but it's still sweltering. The traditional methods give some relief, just not enough. For The World, Abigail Leonard, Tokyo.
Coming up, climate control on a planetary scale. Indigenous leaders in the Amazon basin speak out about the wildfires there. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Emmanuel Macron declared success at this year's G7 summit in southwestern France with plans for the burning Amazon forest, digital tax, and Iran. In his joint statement with President Donald Trump, he said the gathering was productive and efficient. Meanwhile, French protesters in a neighboring city carried hundreds of official portraits of the French president turned upside down. Anne-Sophie Trujillo is one of the organizers. She says Macron is guilty of inaction on climate change.
With this march, our aim was really to demonstrate that speeches of our president, Emmanuel Macron, are far from the reality in terms of climate change here in France.
I think a lot of people will be surprised to hear that, because often Macron has been thought of as a leader who's very tough on climate change and bringing action forward. Where has he fallen short, in your opinion?
There are nice speeches, but the solutions are not there. We do have, I would say, correct targets for 2050, but since the Paris Agreement were signed 4 years ago, all our indicators are on the red marks. We don't have enough local measures for thermal renovation, for development of public transportation, for instance, very recently on aviation. We need action to reduce the aerial transportation. We do need to have more rail transportation. We have solutions that exist. But the government is never at the local level, at national level, taking the steps that has to be done to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions that are raising up and up in France. And so we will never meet our nice objective in 2050. And so we need now no more blah, blah, no more speech, but we need actions.
The march itself is being called La Marche des Portraits, the portrait march, because of the portraits of President Macron that you were carrying while you were demonstrating, holding them upside down. Where did those come from and why were they necessary?
We have decided to remove the portrait from the town halls because of the legal recourses that have been made by Greenpeace and other organizations against France, because the government is not doing enough for action to tackle the climate change. So we have this campaign of Décrochons Macron. So we have been taking more than 120 portraits. We are on trials for that. There are more than 18 trials that are taking place in France.
Yeah, so décrocher Macron, that's like take down Macron. You're literally doing that by taking these portraits off the walls. They were stolen and you're going to trial for this. Is it worth it?
Yes, it is. I think it is, because we are demonstrating that without violence, the coverage has been very good on Sunday for the march. More than 900 persons were there responding to our call. They came with empty frames. Yeah, no, police did not intervene, and we are capturing the public attention.
Notably, President Trump was not at that climate change breakout meeting at the G7, and he's still downplaying the effects of climate change. In fairness, shouldn't you also be carrying upside-down Trump portraits?
Maybe we should, if we can get some.
Anne-Sophie Trujillo with the nonprofit ANV COP21 that helped organize the protests in Bayonne near the G7 summit this weekend. Anne-Sophie, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
The Amazon is still on fire today, and the pressure is growing on Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, to take action. One thing that did come out of the G7 summit in France, world leaders pledged about $20 million for an emergency fund to fight the wildfires in Brazil. The destruction is having a major impact on the indigenous people of the Amazon region. Many indigenous leaders accuse Bolsonaro of allowing farmers and ranchers to set the jungle on fire simply to push out indigenous groups. In the southern Brazilian state of Pará, leaders of the Mencragnati people shared a video on social media that's been getting attention. It shows a gathering of indigenous people in traditional dress. One of the women steps forward to say, here, while the world prays for the Amazon, we're going to resist for the forest, for our children and our grandchildren. Reporter Shannon Sims has been talking with indigenous leaders in the Amazon from her base in Rio de Janeiro. Today, she caught up with Sonia Guadajara, one of the most high-profile leaders in Brazil.
She said something really interesting, that part of what makes the fires so damaging and so dangerous is because the environment of the Amazon has already been degraded. And so the forests that are being set on fire are already in fragments, and it's already in the dry season. And so you have a forest that's already under threat, being further threatened by these fires.
Well, primeiro, pode ser incêndio criminoso, né? Ninguém pode dizer.
So this is Sonia Guarajara. Shannon, tell us what she's saying.
Yeah, she's saying that she knows it could be criminal, the reason for the fires, but she points out later that what she thinks is also a real problem is the weakening of environmental laws and environmental enforcement. So she's saying that part of the problem is that the environment itself is being degraded and the laws aren't being respected.
So these indigenous groups in Brazil and the Amazon, like Sonia's, I mean, they've been trying to get titles to their land, like deeds. What did she tell you these fires mean for those efforts?
This is a struggle that's been going on for decades in Brazil for indigenous people to gain demarcation of their territories. So what that means is essentially that they are able to say, this area from here to here to here to here, this is ours, and we are in charge of this land. However, Sonia says the reality of that is that demarcation by the government means nothing unless the government is willing to enforce that.
Talvez essa demarcação feita pelo governo.
So what she's saying here is that the demarcation is not enough. She's saying that the government could be demarcating land that is not the land that the indigenous people believe is their ancestral territory, but just another plot of land that the government is setting out to satisfy them.
So the struggle for land ownership clearly bound up also with the question of how to protect the forests. You also met a man named Ajilo Munduruku. Munduruku is actually the name of his indigenous group. What's his point of view on all this?
So he's actually in the area, the Upper Tapajós area, which is a large river basin that's fed into a river that feeds into the Amazon River. And so he is right there in the middle of all of these fires that are going on. And he says there are 1,500 indigenous people in the area. And he says they're being greatly impacted by the fires and also by the lack of protection by the federal government. And he goes even further to say that it's white people, quote unquote, those are his words, that are invading the territory of his tribe. And that all they want is peace so they can continue their lives.
Que próximo governo federal que tá atuando hoje, que é o Bolsonaro.
Yeah, in addition to Ajila's concern about the federal government, he also has concerns about President Jair Bolsonaro.
Yeah, what he's saying here is that he believes that the way that Bolsonaro speaks about indigenous people actually harms the population. And he says that he thinks that a lot of white people have a bias against indigenous people. He says that they look at them funny because they speak their own language. And he says that he thinks that that bias has been inflamed by Bolsonaro.
Shannon, you also spoke with Miguel Aparicio. He's an anthropologist who works in the Amazon, and he told you how this demarcation of indigenous lands, giving indigenous groups titles to this land, it's actually a tool to keep the Amazon standing. Let's hear this.
Por exemplo, de que o melhor mecanismo para a proteção da floresta é a demarcação.
Shannon, what was he telling you there?
So what he is saying is that the best mechanism to protect the forest is actually demarcating land to indigenous people. He says that demarcated land has the lowest level of deforestation. And so when you are giving the land to indigenous people, you're raising the chances that that forest will stay standing.
Reporter Shannon Sims in Rio de Janeiro on the Amazon beat for us today. Thanks very much, Shannon. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Shannon's reporting on how fires on indigenous lands are managed will appear in The Atlantic, one of our reporting collaborators. You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
Iranian students under financial pressure in the U.S.
Each night, we check the rate of dollar. And each morning that we wake up, we have to check again. All of your plan change, your program change, your life change.
When U.S. sanctions on Iran are part of your college financial planning, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The G7 summit closed today in Biarritz, France, with talk about another possible summit, a pretty unexpected one between President Trump and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Trump said today he might meet with Rouhani in the next few weeks. This is not Trump's idea. It's the brainchild of French President Emmanuel Macron, who is hosting the G7.
Ce matin, le président Rouhani a clairement dit qu'il était prêt à responder.
Macron told reporters today that he met on the sidelines of the G7 with a surprise guest, Iran's foreign minister Javad Zarif. Macron said he also spoke with President Rouhani on the phone, and he told both Rouhani and Zarif that he believed a new nuclear deal between Iran and the West can be reached. The Trump administration walked away from the old deal last year. Macron was speaking during a joint news conference with Trump, who was asked if he'd be willing to meet with Iran's president.
If the circumstances were correct or the right, I would certainly agree to that. But in the meantime, they have to be good players. You understand what that means.
And they can't do what they were saying they're going to do, because if they do that, they're going to be met with really very violent force. We have no choice. So I think they're going to be good. I really think they'd like to. And I have to tell you, the president's done an excellent job, and we're going to see how it all turns out. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. I say it all the time about everything. Maybe it works, and maybe it doesn't.
Whatever happens next between Washington and Tehran, there's one group of people here in the U.S. that's under pressure because of that strained relationship, and that's college students from Iran. Travel restrictions make it hard for Iranian students to go home to see family. The U.S.-Iran standoff is also upending their education plans in a financial way because of sanctions. The World's Marnette Fedaris has been reporting on this impact on students.
That essentially means that they sometimes have trouble accessing their money from their bank accounts back home. That's the situation that one student that I talked to, Hussein Mogni, ran into when he first came into the U.S.
It is very difficult.
He was a lawyer in Iran. He thought coming to the U.S. would be great for his law practice. He wanted to study international trade law. He wanted to learn English. He made careful plans to make sure that he could afford his studies here in the U.S. But once he got here, basically the relations between the two countries started to sour.
So all of your plan change, your program change, your life change.
And what exactly is so difficult? I mean, can't they open a bank account here in the U.S., these Iranian students?
Sure, they can open a bank account here, but the problem is transferring that money from Iran to the U.S.
Gotcha.
And this all basically started because last year in 2018, the U.S. officially pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal that Iran had with the U.S. and other countries, and they reimposed economic sanctions. So that means there would be penalties for individuals, banks, and companies and governments who trade with Iran. And any sort of transaction that happens from the country to other financial institutions outside of it is deemed suspicious.
So how many students are we talking about who are in this situation? Are there lots of Iranian students in the U.S.?
The last count in the 2017-2018 academic year was about 12,000 Iranian students. Historically, Iran has been one of the top sources of international students to the U.S. A lot of them are in graduate studies and are in engineering, tech, and the medical fields. They're actually filling some worker shortage, especially in the medical fields. And there are also lots of tech companies that were started by Iranian students.
So if they can't access their bank accounts back in Iran, how are they getting money?
It's been pretty difficult. The currency in Iran has plummeted because of these sanctions.
Each night, we check the rate of dollar.
Hossein Mogni.
And each morning that we wake up, we have to check again. And it was terrible.
And essentially, they're paying maybe five times more than what they had initially budgeted for. According to one nonprofit that I talked to, the Public Affairs Alliance of Iranian Americans, they've been fielding hundreds of calls from Iranian students who a lot of them have asked for scholarships or some kind of financial help. So this nonprofit actually had to start a scholarship fund where people could apply to. There's also been crowdfunding. A lot of Iranian students are crowdfunding for their tuition money. And also, I've heard from several students who come up with these workarounds where essentially they would borrow money from Iranian Americans who are here in the U.S. Maybe they're working already or they're already settled here in the U.S. and they borrow from those people, and then their family members exchange money back in Iran.
It does seem all kind of unsustainable, though. So, I mean, what recourse do students have? Are they leaving? Are they going back to Iran?
It's very hard to pinpoint. There aren't exact numbers on people leaving, but we do know that in the last couple of years, there have been less students being issued visas from Iran to the U.S. But I've also talked to several students who are just afraid now that there's all these tensions, and I think that weighs heavier on these Iranian students. So I talked with another student, Ahu Najafian, who is getting her postdoc right now in Carleton College in Minnesota. And she's done her dissertation and has permit to do work and research on the Middle East. But, you know, she kind of voiced this frustration.
We are very worried about anything about our families back in Iran, and I see how I don't even know what to call the sentiments, you know, this not knowing what is going to happen. That's the most frustrating thing.
So it's leaving a lot of students pretty isolated and just not sure about what the future holds.
The World's Barnett Fedaris, thanks very much for being with us and talking about this.
Thank you.
If you've never learned to swim, just imagine how scary it would be as an adult to plunge into the water and try swimming for the first time. Now picture being stranded for days on end in a dinghy at sea while others around you struggle, even perish, because they don't know how to swim. That's happening to migrants making the journey in overcrowded boats from North Africa to Europe. In one part of Italy, there's now a school trying to teach teenage migrants how to overcome their fear of the sea. The World's Orla Barry reports.
I'm in northeast Sicily, in Messina, a port city that's surrounded by water. Many locals here depend on the sea to make a living. For migrants who survive often traumatic boat journeys to get here, it's virtually impossible to escape the water.
Fra quattro giorni.
This is Omar from Senegal. He's telling me about his boat journey from Libya to Messina. He was on board an inflatable boat that got into trouble on the open sea. Omar ended up being rescued by the humanitarian group SOS Mediterranean. He was 15. His friend Ibrahim from Guinea tells me and my interpreter about his rescue at sea.
Did everyone survive who was on the boat? He saw people drowning and he actually saw dead bodies floating around him.
I'm talking to Ibrahim and Omar at Cayo Duilio, a nautical school in Messina. Students here learn about maritime law and are trained to work in the maritime industry. In 2017, it opened its doors to young migrants. But teachers here soon realised there was a problem, says Principal Maria Schiro.
When they were trying to integrate them with the Italian students here in the school, they realised that they were a bit afraid of, you know, going into the sea because they would associate it with their shipwrecks or, you know, with their travels. So they tried to find a way to make them socialize with the Italian students and also fight the fear of the sea for them.
That fear affects a lot of the migrants here. Massimo Sigillo, a phys ed teacher at the school, has become a legal guardian to a teenager from Cameroon. Sigillo says the boy left his home at the age of 13.
So how did he get from Cameroon to here? What was the journey?
2 months walking from Cameroon to Libya. Walking through the desert alone.
On his own?
Yes, on his own. To Libya. Then 45 days waiting the turn for his boat.
The boat capsized not long after it left Libya, and a rescue boat brought him to Messina. Sigillo says the experience has had a profound effect on the teenager.
He doesn't speak about this experience. He's very sad. His eyes are full of clouds. He told us that if he will know what this experience will be for him, he will never start from his home.
He would never have left if he knew what this experience would be.
Yeah. Because it was very, very difficult for him.
Classes with the migrant students began slowly. The school discovered that not only did many of the teenagers not know how to swim, some had barely been to school at all. Principal Schiro said they tried to introduce them gently to classes that involved going into the water.
So they created a specific curriculum for the migrants so that they could have specific classes for them to get acquainted to water in a playful way, and just like beginning with immersion classes and later on swimming classes.
It was scary learning to swim, says Ibrahim from Guinea, after what he had witnessed.
Of course, I was afraid, but thanks to the kind advice from some people here at the school, I was able to slowly fight the fears and try to swim.
As the students become more confident in the water, the school begins to teach them other skills, like CPR and later scuba diving. The classes have had an unexpected outcome, which I find out when I ask Omar what he plans to do when he leaves school.
So his first goal is to graduate, and then after he wants to find a job and possibly in the migrant rescue field. He actually wants to work for NGOs like SOS Mediterranean, the one that rescued him and his friend, like maybe beginning with a lifeguard job here in Sicily and like just connected to rescuing people at sea.
Migrants like Omar have clearly overcome their fear of the water. But this year, Italy began restricting the work of rescue vessels operating off its coast. So it may be some time before Omar and his friends are able to put their newfound skills to work. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Messina, Sicily.
We go now from this world into outer space. NASA is investigating an American astronaut who may have committed a crime in space, accessing her estranged spouse's bank account from the International Space Station. It definitely raises questions about other legal issues that arise when humans travel and even live in space. Mark Sundahl is the director of the Global Space Law Center at Cleveland State University. He says jurisdiction in space is actually pretty straightforward.
We have a number of space treaties dating back to the 60s and 70s, and those treaties are very clear that the state of registry, that is, whatever country launches a space object and then registers it in its own registry in the UN, has jurisdiction and control over that object. And in this case, I think we're talking about the American module of the International Space Station. It's clear that under that treaty, the U.S. would have jurisdiction. But I think the interesting part of this conversation is that it's the beginning of the conversation. This is a first potential crime. And remember, we're presumed innocent until proven guilty. These are among America's finest. But it's a first instance of a potential crime in space. There will be others.
Can you imagine scenarios where this could get complicated, like if humans live or are even born in space? Like what countries would have jurisdiction and whose law would be observed?
Jurisdiction will be pretty clear. I think what will be more problematic is enforcement of the law. Imagine a permanent colony on Mars or the moon, and there's a real crime. Maybe someone rips a hole in someone else's spacesuit on the surface of Mars, and it results in a homicide. How will the court system operate? By Skype? But then how will penalties be imposed? Will there be prisons on Mars? Will we build prisons, or will we evolve into a new, more suitable method of dealing with crimes?
Wow. Oh, those are big questions. Bring us back to the present day, 2019. What's something that is already causing tension in space law right now?
Right now, there are a collection of new, we call them non-traditional space activities. The typical use of space, which everyone is familiar with, is telecommunications, remote sensing, such as Google Earth, GPS, navigational systems. But now private companies and governments are doing things that have never been done before, such as on-orbit refueling and repair of satellites, mining, extraction of natural resources, private space stations being positioned both in the moon or around the Earth, installations on the surface of other celestial bodies. So all of these things are new, and we are developing regulations here in the United States to deal with them domestically to make sure that we comply with our international obligations to continually supervise our nationals in space, but also internationally. There are very fascinating discussions going on in which I'm involved to begin to create a regulatory framework for instance, asteroid mining and the extraction of water and ice on the moon.
Well, clearly space law is a big enough field already that you run this entire academic center dedicated to it. I mean, is the field big and how busy are you?
We're extremely busy. There's a lot of activity. And of course, with the most recent wave of entrepreneurial activity and the advent of reusable rockets, which lowers the barrier to achieving orbit, an entire new space age has been unleashed. And we can only imagine what will happen in the coming years.
Mark Sundahl, the director of the Global Space Law Center and a law professor at Cleveland State University. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You see plenty of them all through the former coal mining towns and valleys of Wales in the west of the UK. Derelict chapels, reminders of the old days when large numbers of locals went to church every week. It's been more than a century since the last big religious revival in the Welsh countryside. Church attendance has dropped way down since the early 1900s. Now a retired minister is buying up some of these religious ruins and planning to reopen them as places of worship. The BBC's Rory Carson reports.
When you think of the Welsh valleys, you immediately think of music like this. Now Many of the small villages and towns in years gone by would have had their own voice choir. And one of the places where people would have come to sing would have been in the chapels. I'm standing in Treharis, one of those places in the Welsh Valleys, which was once a coal mining town, and on the street where I'm currently standing, there's a library down at the bottom, there is a post office, a newsagent's, and when I look to my left, there is this old grey tabernacle chapel.
They used to have Welsh concerts here, and they would go up and say something in Welsh, and sing song, you know. The singing was tremendous in the two chapels. They used to battle against each other, you know.
This chapel was closed, and was going to remain so until Reverend Robert Stivey bought it as part of his mission to reopen at least a dozen of them which had previously been left to rack and ruin. This one, bought last year, opens once a week for a coffee morning. Do any of you remember the chapel when it was open?
I got married, yeah.
You got married here?
Yeah.
Oh, and what do you remember about that day? Was it the best day or the worst day?
I remember I got up there and I looked down and they had odd socks on.
And Robert Skiver, who owns the chapel, decided to give me a tour.
You'll notice there's no big organ here. There's this little one. That was because they had this orchestra up in the gallery for many, many years.
When would that have been?
First chapel was in the 1870s. And then it was enlarged to the size that you see today in the 1890s. In 1904, there was the Welsh Revival, and that meant that places like this were packed. We've got evidence of Evan Roberts, the missioner of the 04 Revival, coming here, and such were the crowds that police had to be on duty outside to marshal them in and out and so forth.
Why did you start buying?
I noticed lots of chapels closing, being demolished, being turned into other uses, just standing derelict. I thought, wow, this is terrible around here. Someone ought to do something about it. The Lord said to me, well, that someone should be you.
Robert now owns 12 chapels. Many of them are listed buildings, meaning they can't be developed, and this current one, it's old-fashioned but well-maintained, and Robert is hoping for a revival.
Now we can raise the roof with this one. Good old revival hymn.
Yeah. Good you or evil, the victory win. There's wonderful power in the blood.
The BBC's Rory Carson there, reporting from the west of the UK. Oak Island, barely a speck in the ocean, less than a quarter square mile of land off the coast of Nova Scotia, but it's a tourist destination with centuries of treasure hunting history. Oak Island also has a nickname, Hoax Island. That's because no treasure has ever been found there. Local diver Tony Sampson talked to us from the boat he skippers. He gives tours of the island to the tourists who come in from across the globe. The treasure hunters naturally head for the Money Pit, where the island's mystery started in 1795.
In fact, it's the world's longest-running treasure hunt. And the crazy thing is, we still don't know what we're looking for.
Legend says three men started digging on Oak Island and found a stone with a hidden message 90 feet below ground.
When they reached the 90-foot stone, it was believed to say 40 feet below lies £2 million. So whether that was pounds sterling, a British treasure, or pounds in weight, nobody knows. There's been coins found in the last 200 years. There's been jewellery. There's been artifacts. I think this is sort of every little boy's dream, from my point of view, to go out there and look for treasure in the hope of finding it.
Historian Richard Joltes has been debunking the mystery of Oak Island for nearly three decades. He says dreams of finding treasure are not based in reality.
Really, Oak Island is the great survivor treasure legend of a lot of treasure legends that were running around the eastern United States and into Canada in the 18th and 19th centuries. The documentary evidence suggests that nothing was ever actually built there or buried there.
But that doesn't dissuade Skipper Sampson. He'll be on the island looking for treasure until it is found.
I believe that all through Nova Scotia here, there's treasure, not just on islands, but also in the ocean, because the ships in those days, they didn't have obviously the fancy things we do now as far as GPS and navigational plotters and sounders. So, I mean, there's a reason they call this whole area out around Sable Island and Nova Scotia the graveyard of the Atlantic. And there's thousands and thousands of shipwrecks out here.
And they continue searching, even with virtually zero evidence to show for it. I get the romance and the lure of a treasure hunt, but facts, people, facts. Facts are on my mind, not just because that's our job as journalists, but because this weekend someone left us who knew so well just how crucial facts are. Ken Bader was a longtime editor here at The World. He died of cancer on Saturday. Ken retired a number of years ago, but we still remember him as a man of facts, of good writing, of principle. His defense of the fundamentals of journalism are still with us and you every day when we put out the show. Ken Bader's humor and calm under pressure are also part of our DNA. We are still very much Baderized every day. Thank you, Ken. We miss you. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios, I'm Marco Werman. Join us again tomorrow, won't you?
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.